Nicholson. Michael Nicholson, Reel 13.
So, the ITN Scoop went out on that Sunday, as I remember, and that was, that must have been the 21st of July. 21st of July, Sunday. And the fear everywhere now, because this has now taken international proportions, this wasn't just a fight between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots on a tiny little island. This was now, you know, threatening NATO, because both these countries belong to NATO. And what was in the offing was not just a small fight in Cyprus, but a major war between Turkey and Greece, both who had, you know, big armies and could inflict a great deal of damage. And the colonels in Athens sent an ultimatum to Ankara, and said that that either you stop this action and you pull out your invasion force, and I think they'd given a deadline by 2 o'clock that afternoon on Sunday the 21st, or we go to war with you. I mean, that was it. And an American, there was an American go-between, Joseph Sisko, who was, I think, Under Secretary of State, and he was the kind of go-between peacemaker. We heard in Nicosia over the BBC World Service that the Turks had already sunk three Greek ships that were taking supplies, resupplies, military resupplies to Cyprus. The Soviet Union declared a state of military alert. The United States started sending its sixth fleet, diverting its sixth fleet to Cyprus, including a huge aircraft carrier. And that you had. And you also had four resident armies now in Cyprus. You had the Greek, I forget how many there were. I think it was 3,000 or 4,000 Greek soldiers there. You had now, I think it was about 15,000 Greeks there, Greek soldiers. You had now, within the space of, you know, 36, 48 hours, you had 40,000 Turks. You had 5,000 United Nations soldiers. And you had something like 11,000-12,000 British regulars there. So you had something like 70,000 troops on this tiny little island, all within rifle fire of each other. So it was a very, very explosive situation. So this is what we were hearing now. On the World Service, we had our own little stories to do. You know, we weren't giving the broad picture. All we could do every day from now on was to provide ITN with the small cameos of what was going on in the island. We went to Famagusta. That was the kind of Costa del Sol of Cyprus. It's where all the British tourists went. I remember writing that normally, you know, business was bad in Famagusta if you could see the sand between the bodies on the beach. Now the beaches were empty, the hotels were empty. While we were there, the Turkish Phantom jets were coming in and rocketing the hotels. We were on our way back to Nicosia, and Alan was driving. Again, going through these. This is, you know, I mentioned earlier that the road out of Nicosia going towards Kyrenia, where we were, is a very flat stretch, open plains, which is why it was chosen for the parachute landings. But the road we were on that day was very hilly, almost mountainous, very rocky, very dry, arid, almost desert-like. And we were driving back to Nicosia. Alan was driving, and suddenly, boof, there was a burst of machine gun fire. And we skidded to a stop. I was in the right-hand seat, so I was in the left-hand seat. Alan was driving, that's right. Alan was driving. I got out the left-hand seat and ran around the front of the car right. And Alan did the opposite. He got out of the driving seat and ran left, so we suddenly found ourselves on different sides of the road. I lay flat on the ground, and we heard this machine gun go again, light machine gun, obviously firing at hitting the car. I shouted out to Alan, he couldn't hear me. I started then shouting who I was to whoever was firing at us. I tried to identify myself. And there was no machine gun fire, but then there was suddenly, I heard this sniper bullet, just a single fire. It's a zing. So I kind of, quite terrified, I suppose. You have to realize that if you were in artillery shelling, and it's indiscriminate, there's a certain safety. You feel a certain safety. Partly because I suppose you're wearing a little card around your neck which says press. And you don't, because it gives you a sense of kind of, well, I'm a spectator. They're not firing at me, therefore I'm safe. And I think I once wrote that because you're press and because you have a press card, it's a bit like the old Zulu impis in the old days who used to smear themselves with magic potions, which they thought protected them from the bullets, and the bullets of the British redcoats. And I think being a journalist in a war zone, you feel that certain safety, certain security, when there is this indiscriminate fire. But when you're lying face down on a rock in temperatures, you know, approaching 100, and you have one man who you can't see, who you know is firing at you and only you, well, that's quite a different situation. It gives you quite a different kind of feeling. And every time I shouted out to him, his bullet got closer. He obviously had an excellent shot. And these weren't, you know, these weren't random shots. The man was aiming to miss me. It was obvious. I tried to crawl to a culvert, and he put a bullet just a couple of yards to my left to stop me. So obviously he knew what he was doing. And I thought, well, either I dive sunstroke, because, I mean, you can't believe how hot it was. I had no covering at all. And the sun was really burning into me. Or I make a dash for it. And before I can make this decision, which might well have cost me my life, one way or the other, I suddenly heard a vehicle stop. And I kind of turned my head, and running down scampering down the side of the road, because the road was built up high, were two British soldiers wearing United Nations blue helmets. I knew they were Brits because they were shouting, keep down, don't move. And they lay alongside me. And I explained to them what was happening as best I could. I think I must have been close to tears. and they shouted out. And again, boom, boom, a couple of bullets came down. And then the machine gun opened up again, but just above our heads. I mean, obviously not aiming for us. The soldiers again tried to identify themselves, but there was no response. And so they said, right, this guy's having a game with us. And if he'd wanted to kill us, he'd have killed us by now. He's just having a game. Let's go. I mean, that's the way the military mind works. And so they grabbed me, and I was pulled up the embankment, and we were shoved into this jeep, and off we went. And as we left, we could hear the machine gun following us. And in what the soldier said was of a very professional way, they were just saying, keep going, keep going, keep going, you know. A bit like spraying with a hose pipe from behind, you know what I mean? When I got back to the base, Alan and Bob were already there. They'd made their own decision, but either they died of sunstroke or heatstroke, or they died from a bullet, and they decided they'd do it the quick way. But thankfully for them, they'd gone the right side, so the sniper couldn't see them. I'd gone the wrong side, and they could see me. So that was a very, very unpleasant experience. But what happened after that was that you had an island now full of soldiers, 70-odd thousand soldiers, as I said, but you had many thousands of tourists who were trapped there. One particular story I remember, I think I forgot to say that the night, two nights before the invasion, we'd been in Kyrenia, It was a very nice, very pretty little port with a castle, and it was a bit like, it reminded me of Saint-Tropez in a way, kind of poor man's Saint-Tropez. Very good little Turkish restaurants there. And we'd eaten there, Bob, Alan and I. And then we'd got into a pub, British-style pub that sold Red Baron and Guinness. And we recognised, there were four people at the bar, two young couples. And we recognised the accent. They were from Northern Ireland. And, you know, Alan and I and Bob had spent a long time in Northern Ireland, so we chatted about Belfast. And they were two RUC policemen who'd saved up for a holiday in Cyprus with their wives, young wives. And we're going to have a great time. And, of course, 2 days later, they found themselves in the middle of a war. So it was really from the frying pan into the fire. But they were just among the many thousands who needed now to be evacuated, because who knew what was going to happen next? The whole island could explode. Just needed a spark to do it. So the Royal Navy came in. Hermes, the aircraft carrier that I was to have much to do with many years later in the Falklands, took me down to the Falklands. Hermes came in, Devonshire came in, and a couple of other boats, Royal Naval boats, came in to evacuate the thousands, and there were many thousands, upwards, I think, of 10,000. I may be wrong, but certainly between 6,000 and 10,000 foreign nationals, many, many thousands of Brits, including Brits who lived on the island, who had to now be evacuated. So they were being evacuated from Kyrenia. And the Royal Air Force were airlifting thousands out of Akrotiri. And the British officer commanding there had to somehow get a ceasefire. What was his name? Sir John Aitken. He was commander of British forces there. And he broadcast over British forces network, appealing both to the Greeks and the Turks for enough time to allow these people to leave. And this huge convoy of cars that had to be that were taking people to the ports and to Akrotiri. And he said that all the cars would be flying flags of their own countries, British Union Jack especially. And the British troops would be escorting them, and the British troops were given instructions only to fire in self-defense. And so what we describe, what the press described as the mini Dunkirk or the Great Trek was underway. We filmed a convoy of private cars and vans, camper vans, caravans, over 3 miles long, bumper to bumper, going to, I think, Decalia. That was the principal. That was in the middle of the midway between the two. And that was the main assembly point. And as I said, they went to the ports, they went to the aircraft, and they were away. And I remember that one headline, I forget which British newspaper it was, headlined that only the Brits could do it. And I think on that particular day, wherever you came from, whatever your nationality, and whatever you thought of the Brits, a few queried the headline, because it was immaculately done, and not a piece of blood was spilt. So that really was the end of the story. It was the end of the line for the Greek colonels. Of course, they'd attempted this coup. The Turks had responded. The Turks had won. They'd got their what they promised they would have, their Attila line, dividing Turkey very dramatically, and geographically, politically into two. And they could have taken the entire island had they wished to. There was no doubt about that. But I think the warnings from both the Russians and from America prevented them from doing so. So they had their Attila line, and. And as so often happens, provided an opportunity for democracy to raise its uncertain head, because the Greek colonels were toppled. Just as many years later, the Argentine junta was of generals was toppled by their own man-made war. So the colonel's war was suicide for them. And of course, once they'd gone, Greece had an opportunity to try and return to democracy. There were no British casualties, certainly no British press casualties, until, in fact, the war was over. And it was very sad. The BBC crew were filming on the Turkish side, where the Turks had laid a lot of mines. And, well, I don't know whose fault it was, whether they'd ignored, you know, most of the... Most minefields are eventually ringed with a skull and crossbones sign warning you that it's a minefield. But it was too early, perhaps, for these signs to be put up, so it was very dangerous to travel around. And the BBC crew went into to a minefield. A guy called Ted Stoddard, who was a BBC sound recordist, realised where they were, stepped out of his car to warn the cars behind, immediately stepped onto a mine, stumbled and then stepped onto another mine and was blown up. All this being filmed in a very, I suppose, callous way by a cameraman a few cars back. So that was really the one and only tragedy for us. I was pulled out of Cyprus and sent to Greece. Even then, I think, don't worry about that. Can you hear it? It doesn't worry you? It's my fax. I was pulled out of Cyprus and sent to Greece because I think even then they thought Greece might respond by crossing the Turkish border. But they didn't, of course. And that was the end of it, except that I got home, and within a week, I got a letter from the Lady of Palace. I'd had a few herograms from my own company, but I got a letter from the Lady of Palace, and it was the bill. And I must read you the letter that the manager of the Lady of Palace sent me. He said, "We hope that you had a pleasant journey home and that your stay at the hotel was an enjoyable one," and this they emphasized by underlining it, "up to the unfortunate moment when the Turkish invasion broke out, for which I'm sure we all will have a memorable experience. I have invoiced your account up to the 19th of July. Thanking you in advance, we look forward to welcoming you back at the Ladra Palace on better conditions in due course." Now that letter was dated the 11th of August, and it's now August 2001, all these years on, and they're still brokering for peace in Cyprus. It is still a divided country. Anyway, I shall be welcomed back to the Ladra Palace in due course, hopefully at the usual press discount.